Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
So, hey everybody, on today's episode of Whiskey Neat, we wanted to try something a little different. We wanted to have on, part of what makes this hobby fun is sitting with people and simply talking over a nice pour of something interesting. Interesting conversation, interesting spirits, it's what makes this hobby so much fun. So today I have on probably one of the most interesting people I've had on so far, Dr. Steve Platts, the Deputy Chief Scientist of the Human Research Program at NASA. That is a mouthful, and it is just an honor. So I'm super excited. We had an absolute blast. Steve is he's been working at Johnson Space Center for the past 15 years. He's got a postdoctoral in cardiovascular physiology. Yep. Mm-hmm. And he also teaches – he's got several certifications in spirits, not only being a – doctor with the human body, he also has a vast background in spirits. And my buddy Winston, who is the international, you're international, you go all over, right?
Yeah.
International brand ambassador for Balcones. And we talk spirits, we talk space, and we have a really good time. This episode is sponsored by Balcones. Without further ado, Dr. Steve Platts and Winston Edwards. Cheers, guys.
Thank you.
Dude, thanks so much for being here, guys. Steve,
yeah,
Winston, sure. I'm a big fan of Balcones, and I'm a big fan of space and Star Wars.
There you go.
So
join the resistance.
You're a big deal. I mean, so tell me.
In the big picture, no.
Tell me the chief deputy scientist of the Human Research Program for NASA. What does that mean?
So the Human Research Program, we're in charge of doing the research that we need to figure out the risks of going into space. And right now we're really focusing on exploration, getting to Mars and back. What does it do to the human body, short term and long term? What are the risks? How do we ameliorate those risks, whether it's by prevention or treatment, which we call a countermeasure? So a medicine you take here on Earth, we would call a countermeasure. And then we also inform standards and permissible limits. So what's the CO2 limit on station or on the new vehicle? What's the radiation exposure limit? So we do the research that allows us to come up with those kind of things.
So we're this podcast is going to be full of my attempt at humor, but this is essentially testing Avatar, right? Like, just like how long you can be in space to get to like Mars or beyond.
Yeah, I mean,
as
we
the
know
human body.
We know that to get to the missions we're thinking of now, it's going to be 30 months or so. We've never been in space that long. You know, the longest people have been in space is just over a year, and we just recently had our 1 year mission come back.
Kelly.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just a year in space fully.
Yeah, it was just slightly under a year, but we call it a 1 year mission. And then, you know, people don't realize that a 1 year mission in space, we did research for a year before that and then a year after that. So it's really a 3 year commitment to do that type of work. And we also had a 1 year cosmonaut that they did it together in tandem. Kornienko from Russia, he also did the same mission, the 1 year mission.
Do you run tests on the cosmonaut as well, or is it two separate medical?
We did some with him, but we didn't do as many as we did with Scott. And that's just because of logistics of trying to do things and integrating our program. But we did do several research studies that we fully collaborated with the Russians, where they would be on console over in Russia while we were on console over in the U.S. while the experiments were going on, and we'd be talking to each other and talking to Scott and doing those kind of things.
Yeah, this is going to be a long podcast, I hope.
I know, I can't. Drone on. Sorry.
I'm in for the long haul.
No. I wasn't saying because you were drawing, because I have so many questions coming to mind as you're talking about what this really means. You essentially, the next step would be, I'm assuming you're going to push the limits of even that. Are you going to try a 2-year?
Yeah, that's really difficult. There are people discussing that, but the logistics for that are very, very difficult. One thing we are doing is we're working with the Russians to do isolation studies. I don't know if you've heard of the Mars mission. Mars 500 actually went a little over 500 days, but they did a 500-day isolation study in Moscow with an international crew. And we're working with them now.
Where they were alone for 500 days?
Yeah, they're isolated. They talk to a mission control just like you would, and they run scenarios and do research inside that facility as if they are going somewhere in space.
What were the downsides of that? Like, what were the back?
Well, you can imagine you put a number of people who haven't known each other long term, right? They've met just before, trained for a few weeks, put them in a can
and
for that amount of time, and just think of the kind of things that can happen, right? Personality conflicts, and then you start to get on each other's nerves over time, right? Even if you really know each other and like each other, it's just you can't go anywhere. You can't get away from the other crew. And we have experiments that make them interact so we can study teamwork. So we can figure out what that dynamic will be like for a longer-term mission. So those kind of things are really interesting. And we have an entire research group within our program that just studies behavioral health. And so multiple studies doing those kind of things.
I don't know the professional way of asking this question, but is there some sort of accounting for, I'll put it this way, pent-up energy?
In our studies, that's not part of the study paradigm, and other studies deal with that in different ways, but we don't.
It's out of scope for
it
your
is.
Focus.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of when you talk about 500 days in isolation, mm-hmm. it immediately is akin to, at least in my mind, in the basic form of being in prison for 500 days and the effects that has in prison with. Mm-hmm. Pent up energy would be the right way to put it.
Now, I mean, there are some differences. They have a little more room than that, right? And more interaction, personal interaction. And then also, they have a lot of work to do. So when we do our isolation studies, we do have exercise equipment because we know we're going to exercise going to Mars. So we want them to exercise in our facilities. Now, each facility can be a little different. Some might have different types of exercise equipment. We have a facility at JSC that's a shorter term isolation study. And there we have a cycle and we have some free weights that they can do some exercise. And then also we try and, in order to keep their minds engaged, we simulate a mission. And so in Hera, which is our facility, which is, like I said, a shorter duration, they're essentially told that they're going to an asteroid, they're going to interact with that asteroid, they're going to do a walk on the asteroid, they're going to collect rock samples, then they're going to come back on and analyze them. So we compress the time that it would be, but there we have monitors on the walls as if those are windows. And so we're showing them space. We show them the asteroid when we get close. We show them Earth.
You immerse
when they're
them
returning.
In
we
that
do.
Reality.
And oftentimes they'll tell us they forgot they were on Earth and they were thinking they were really on a ship.
Like being in a movie theater and stepping out into the light and realizing, oh, it's daytime. I mm-hmm. completely forgot.
Yeah, I mean, even when they launch, right? So we have a ceremony when they go into the facility and then they launch. We have speakers under the floor that vibrate it as if they are taking off. I mean, we try to make it as realistic as we can, but still keep the research as pure as we can because we all know that, you know, on space station, it's really hard to do pure science because you have to run the station.
Yeah.
And you have humans involved. So there's always things that you have to make compromises for. So we try and get the analogs that we do here on Earth as clean as possible so then we can relate that to what's going to happen in space.
Sounds like a really awesome VR experience.
Yeah, you know, that's part of it. We have VR built into it so that they can do their EVA and collect the rocks. And then when they come in, they have little rocks.
For the listening audience, EVA.
It's a spacewalk.
Okay.
So extravehicular activity.
Yeah. So I'm sure there's going to be a lot of acronyms, and I try to be mindful of those listening who don't know. And of course, I don't know. I'm an idiot. But there are some. I mean, even within I've mentioned before, I work in aviation. I'm mm-hmm. more familiar with certain. I forget that people don't necessarily remember Zulu time, or mm-hmm. you know. So you've got to be mindful of that. But the that just sounds like an incredible, both fun. You know, part of this as a job, I'm sure it's got to be tremendously fun. You know, you get to talk with good people and try new things, but you get to I don't want to say play video games, but you really are planning for the human race down line. I mean, a couple decades from now, when are we projected to hit Mars? What's the goal there?
In the early to mid 30s. So we have a 4-phase plan.
It's our timeline, that will get us our lifetime.
To Mars, and that's phase 4. Right? So we'll orbit first, do a flyby, as we call it, and then
come back?
Landing. Yes, come back. Everything for NASA is coming back. That's a private company that proposed the one-way journey. That's not us.
So it's each step and then come back.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially, when you get to the stage, you do the flyby, you come back, then you've got to plan a whole new one going there and actually landing.
Yep, and landing right now is outside of our window, only for planning purposes. We know that that's where we're going, but all of the planning we're doing now kind of stops at the orbiting, because it's so far away.
Right. You're right. Focusing on that right now.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens if, let's say, something – is the plan going to stay the same regardless of what happens? Meaning if an orbit – when we try to orbit, we find out there's no coming back around the other side. We end up – keep going.
Well, luckily the laws of physics don't change very much. Right? So orbital mechanics, we're pretty sure once you get to the other side, we're going to come back around. Unless something like Apollo 13 happens, which, you know, is – we have contingencies,
which is what I was referring to. Yeah,
yeah. There are always contingencies for things, and you always learn things as you go. But we are taking it in steps. So right now, we're working on flying a new station, in cislunar orbit for the moon.
Cislunar.
So there are Lagrange points. So there are places that you can create stable orbits, so you don't have to burn a lot of energy to stay in orbit. And that's one of the –
you're looking
at
building
the other side of the moon.
Correct. Okay. So we've got our space station. You're wanting to build another one in orbit around our moon.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And so a little stepping stone.
Yes.
Okay. Yep. Gotcha.
And then potentially, you know, you could do lots of different things there. But that's sort of one of our stepping points. And then – you know, what do we have to do to get us to Mars? And there are lots of things going on now to try and get us there. Like, how do we do the food? Because if you calculate out the volume and the weight of the food, it's huge. So how do we deal with that? Well, we're doing experiments in collaboration with some of our other NASA partners on growing food.
Farming
not
in space.
Potatoes.
Like that movie?
In the dirt, like the movie. But, you know, lettuce and then tomatoes are going up and radishes are going up and, you know, kept doing the nutritional thing and the psychological. I mean, it almost becomes like your pet. You've been feeding and watering this little plant. Then you get, for the first time in a while, something fresh and crunchy to eat. And it's a big psychological stimulus. So all that type of stuff, we're working on that now. And how do we do food bars or whatever we need to do that deliver better nutrition?
Complete nutrition.
Yeah. Yes. And are palatable. Because a lot of things that are great, I mean, go down the protein bar aisle at the grocery store, and a lot of those don't taste very good. We eat them because we need to, you know, whether we're working out or for just the protein content. But if you were to give those, you get tired of those very quickly. So how do we vary their diet? How do we add things to their diet? Because one of the problems we've had in the past is astronauts tend to lose weight in space. Your taste
buds change.
Tend to
grow a little bit too, right?
Yeah, and that's temporary. So when you're outside of the gravitational field, the cartilage, the discs between your vertebrae expand a little bit.
Right. There's no weight pushing on them.
Right. You're not being compressed down. So you get a little bit taller. But as soon as you come back to Earth, that goes away. Because as soon as you're back in 1G, you're compressed back down. There was a little confusion about that a little while ago in the media about, you know, how much do they grow and how long does that last? But it's very temporary. So, but people like to brag, hey, I'm 2 centimeters taller this month. Yeah. You know, it's kind
of
a
the same thing about when you get up in the morning. You know, you decompress as you lay down in your bed. You might be, you know, half an inch or something taller in the morning. So they say.
Yeah, yeah.
Texas single malt next. Of course, you know, it's our flagship. The whole reason we started Balcones 10 years ago was literally to make this specific whiskey.
Next year.
Oh,
dude!
Sorry,
you're cut off.
Yeah, I saw the bulge in the cup, and I thought it was sitting on something. See how it's off center? No worries.
But anyway, yeah. So 10 years ago, the whole idea behind Balcones was to make this whiskey right here, and we kind of said to ourselves, like, how hard could it be? You know, the original distillers were all homebrewers. That's how they knew each other, was from homebrew clubs, and they basically said, we know the first step of making malt whiskey really well, because malt whiskey is just beer that died and went to heaven. And they said, we could probably figure out the rest. And here we are, like, still, like, trying to perfect the recipe 10 years later. Really awesome thing I want to mention about the single malt this morning. We just put out a press release a couple hours ago. It was named Best Craft Whiskey at the San Francisco World Spirits Competition, which I know competitions are...
hotly debated.
Yeah, hotly debated. Yeah. But the San Francisco competition is one of the most well-known and one of the most well-respected in the industry. So that's a really huge accolade for us, especially in the middle of our 10th anniversary, basically.
I mentioned this earlier. We so for those who don't know, the issue that a lot of some whiskey fanatics have with competitions is they feel like it's pay to play, meaning that you pay X amount of dollars to get in, you send two bottles, and almost everyone gets an award. That being said, that may be the case for some, sure. But even if you don't respect the idea of competitions, you guys make a quality product and are consistently awarded above and beyond across multiple competitions, above and beyond others. So I mentioned earlier, Stillhouse just won an award for best packaging design, and they're in that turpentine can. So it's something that a lot of people will scoff at. But Balcones is consistently, I would say, easily the... You could say maybe the St. Arnold or the Shiner Bock of Texas in regards to whiskey, because it's like the most iconic, has come the furthest, has done the most innovation. As far, I mean, it could be debatable, but I think that you guys have done one of the best jobs in producing a consistent product, even though, and you guys doubled distillation twice over the past couple of years.
More than that, yeah, yeah.
So you guys, even with an increase in scale, the product has stayed consistent. So I'm a big fan either way.
And you know, another thing about competitions is that I find the people that are contesting them most often are, you know, your top 1% of drinkers, the kind of people that have bunkers of hundreds of bottles. It's like, we don't enter competitions to market to these guys, you know? It's like, that's the kind of person I'm going to meet at a whiskey show, and we're going to talk one-on-one about the whiskey, you know? And they're not going to care about the awards, and that's fine. But the awards are about raising awareness of the whiskey and saying, like, hey, you've never heard of us before, but these people who you probably respect for their palates, you know, like Anthony Diaz Blue, you know, running the San Francisco competition, it's like, you may not know us, and we can't tell you the whiskey's good because you don't know us, but so-and-so from this competition said it was really great. So, you know, maybe take a leap of faith on that.
Of course.
And, you know, I'm sorry. That's not unique to spirit competitions. You have all of these wine competitions.
Yep.
And, you know, all of these people come out with gold medals. And for the definition of that for some of these competitions is, if you submit a Chardonnay and it tastes like Chardonnay, you get a gold medal.
Yep.
Really? So it's, you know, it's not unique to the spirits industry and how they do their awards. And some are, you know, a little higher stature. You mentioned San Francisco. Everyone knows that competition. But there are so many all over the country and all over the world. And, you know, you have to understand the context.
Yeah, I'm getting a request for a new competition every week in my email. It's like, oh, enter the Shogun Japanese Spirits Competition. I'm like, well, that's nice. We don't distribute in Asia, but thanks.
There's a local guy, Randy Svetlik, and I have been talking about potentially doing that with the Houston Rodeo. They have a wine thing, but a credible one that's a bit more stringent with award giving away. I'm a I have a lot of anxiety with the idea because it is something that is scoffed at by many. Plus, I also don't want to be that guy that's constantly pestering brands. I remember pestering you several years ago about the idea of a whiskey festival. So it's putting yourself out there with one event is probably all I have patience for. Trying to put together a thing, I would love to. I think there's definitely a market for that. We currently have the largest community in the nation here in Houston, and it's something that is phenomenally, I'd say it was well done, but it's a mixed bag of pros and cons. But Balcones is, you guys have 10 years and you guys are as consistent gets, and I couldn't be happier with it. I mean, the only thing missing on this table is the Rumble Cask Reserve and the
Rum Cask Finished Malt.
Yeah, out of your core range, and then what's the...
So the core range is traditionally Baby Blue, Texas Single Malt, Rumble, and Brimstone.
Brimstone, that's what I was trying to think of.
Texas Rye 100 and True Blue 100 are both going to be part of the core portfolio moving forward.
Okay.
So it's no longer a core four, it's now a core six.
And you guys, I mentioned Dublin Distillation. You're the only brand I know of that has tried to increase in size and subsequently drop the prices of some of your products.
And it's not so much that we dropped the price. It's just that while Balcones was hotter than sliced bread for, those couple of years after the New York Times article in 2013, we were making 2,000 or 3,000 cases a year at that point. So we were just a drop in the bucket compared to a lot of these bigger brands. But because the whiskey was so scarce and in such high demand, a lot of retailers would bump the price up a little bit because they figured they can get more money for it since it's in demand. Same thing happens with, the BTAC and the Pappies of the world. So, there's still shops you can go to in like New York City and they're charging $120 for single malt. So the MSRP has always been a lot lower than what you would find it on the shelf. But now that the supply is a lot more consistent, you're starting to see a lot more price consistency on the shelf as well. And there's still people out there that are charging a little extra and there's nothing we can really do about that. But
you guys did drop the price of MSRP on the Baby Blue.
Baby Blue, yeah. We dropped it $10 from $49.99 to $39.99.
I don't know of any other so again, for those who are not aware, Texas whiskey tends to be much younger and much more expensive. And to have a brand that has grown so much and expanded and subsequently not only maintained consistency but dropped their price on something, it's a bit unheard of. Most brands that expand, like for instance Wild Turkey and a few other distilleries I know of in Kentucky, are in the process of building a bunch of new rick houses. They're not doing that with the plans of dropping the prices on their product.
Oh yeah.
So the fact that you guys knowingly take a loss when you could get more with the hopes of improving, and not only the implication there is that you may influence other brands to follow step, because if all of a sudden you can get a 100 proof or cast strength product out of Texas for sub $50 and everyone else is more expensive, it's going to force them to reconsider things.
Yep.
So I applaud you guys for that much at least.
Yeah. Well, we figured, when we moved into the new distillery, there were some serious cost of goods savings. For one, we're no longer buying grain in 50-pound bags pre-milled. We buy it by the truckload now. So obviously, there's significant savings there that we decided to pass on to the consumer. Also, partially because when we set prices for a lot of our whiskeys, it was done by people that never had been in the spirits industry before. So we felt like Baby Blue would be a lot more competitive, especially to some certain products that are made.
Have eagles on them?
There are certain products that are made here in Texas that have a lower price point than us, and we thought we would be a lot more competitive against that brand, letting people trade up for another $5 more. You can get a genuinely Texas distilled whiskey instead of Brand X.
Now, you actually, and I will definitely get in on this on a different podcast because I plan on having Mark Schilling on. All of these have the Go Texan logo on it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a hotly debated topic. And we've talked about some aspects of potential changes and ideas for that. I definitely want to get into that on a different podcast.
Yeah.
But when
I'm sure we can get into it with Mark.
When Mark Schilling gets here and throw in Travis Whitmire and his colorful language, I think we can really talk about what bothers so many people about the GoTexan yep. logo. So it's not necessarily a bad thing. It's not a bad thing to have it on there, but there's a lot of people getting away with having it on there who it's not made in Texas. So, but that being said, I had a question I had written down before I spilled whiskey all over a paper. You were talking about stair-stepping to the moon.
Mm-hmm.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought I recall at one point that the International Space Station is not actually supposed to go be up there forever. That it is planning to come back at some point or crash at some point or something
well,
at some point.
I hope it doesn't crash. There is an end of life.
What is that end of life?
Before
we get to Mars?
Yes. So, but the anticipation, these kind of things are always fluid and there are always discussions. And remember, it's government and actually not just our government, the International Space Station. So
yeah.
Russia, the European Space Agency, the Canadian Space Agency, the Japanese Space Agency, and lots of others are invested here. So it's not just us deciding how things go. But what you hear most is that we're not going to deorbit it. What would happen is it would probably be taken over by a commercial entity, and then it would still be available for things. What those things are, you know, we don't know.
But sell it off.
Essentially. And then it would be available
McDonald's.
To do that. I don't think they're one of the companies we've heard about.
I imagine there's an – rhymes with Talon Trusk, who might be interested in buying it.
SpaceX. You never know who might be. I mean, we're partners with them. They're – going back and forth for us with cargo. Hopefully they'll get man rated soon and then we can fly our crew up
Piggyback.
On SpaceX. Yeah, and a lot of our experiments, the only way we can get samples back is on SpaceX because they have the capability to bring back frozen samples and things like that. And so we work with them quite a bit.
So what is the idea that you guys initially, I thought you were saying it's a stair step between the International Space Station and the Moon's Space Station. Let's just call it the Moon Space Station.
Yeah, we call it Gateway.
Okay. Hmm? Gateway.
I like
love
it.
Love it.
I like
love
it. Yeah.
Gateway. It sounds like the next...
Not Stargate. Gateway.
I was about
Since
to say...
Since we're all sci-fi kind of guys.
I was about
to
say... I
mean, Stargate would be a lot cooler.
It would be so cool.
Oh, you know what? So, just a quick diversion. Being at NASA, right, we're always developing new technologies and always spinning up new projects to try and find something new and innovative and interesting. You would be shocked the number of times that those technologies, their like in-house nickname is tricorder or transporter or replicator or something. Almost everyone there is Star Trek. Star Wars
of
or
course.
Both, you know, you
are
get
there battles like which one's better.
You know, there are all kinds of memes that go
yeah.
around and
that's great.
And there's one that's hilarious that I think I've posted like 12 times. And so it has a picture of the Millennium Falcon and the Enterprise. And it's like, you know, I plan to raise my children, you know, exposing them to all the different religions. And then when they're old enough, they'll get to decide between Star Trek and Star Wars.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. And so, you know, you've probably seen it. I've posted it a whole bunch of times.
I haven't seen it. I haven't seen it. But
I post lots of space geeky kind of stuff.
You're right. It's the same exact. It's the people who grew up. That's probably what inspired them to be involved in space is these sci-fi shows. I think they're an important part of our culture. I remember growing up, my father felt that they were silly. But this is a big part of what – I mean, your phone case,
mm-hmm.
right? So what's that from? Star Wars.
That's Star Wars.
Yeah. So it's something that you're clearly a fan, mm-hmm. and now you get to play Star Wars mm-hmm. for real.
Yep.
So at least pre-Star Wars.
Yeah, think about the shows. I mean, their communicator is a cell phone.
Yeah.
You know, back when that
iPad?
Was made – Exactly.
Yeah, they got
the tricorder. We have things like that. We have medical devices
Flat
that
Earth.
We can diagnose.
Know,
so don't let's not go there.
We're starting to 3D print meat.
Yeah.
You know, and we can 3D print tools and things
yeah.
on station right now. We have
let's
that capability.
Let's not forget artificial intelligence. We're working on robots and, you know, for various purposes.
And there are multiple studies working on that on the space station as well. Interacting with the crew. How do they do that? How do they communicate?
Get an Alexa on the International Space Station?
Yeah, except the ones that are being proposed actually float and move around.
Oh my gosh.
They're much more sci-fi like than just Alexa. So wow. You know, there's some pretty cool stuff.
That actually brings up a really interesting question I thought of. There's a lot of emerging technologies right now, mm-hmm. a lot of really exciting stuff from 3D printing to carbon nanotubes and whatever else. Is there anything in particular that you see is going to like really
change the game?
Yeah. I mean, what's coming out that mm-hmm. you think is going to make your life and the astronauts' life so much easier mm-hmm. or, you know, just make
and no
make
one's
everything
listening
safer?
To this, so you can break whatever NDA you signed and let us know.
There are a couple things. So the whole concept of miniaturization is critical for us.
Yes.
And I'll use one of the things I've used when I've done my research, because before I did management, I actually did research in the laboratory. I was the head of the cardiovascular research laboratory. That's my training, is in cardiovascular physiology. So we use ultrasound a lot. If you think about it, you can't fly an MRI on the space station because it weighs way too much and it costs thousands of dollars per pound to fly. And another is a 3 Tesla magnet would crush the station.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Just think about all that metal, right? There's no possible way to do anything like that. So we do a lot of ultrasound. We use ultrasound for things that people never thought of on Earth. We use it for looking at the eye, the heart, the gut, the lungs, the brain. I mean, all kinds of things. But the ultrasound machine I used in my laboratory weighed a couple hundred pounds. And we had one like that on station for a long time. Now, they're the size of a laptop.
Wow.
And that's what's on station now, is a laptop-sized ultrasound machine. The new ultrasound machines coming out are cell phone-sized. So just imagine the capabilities that you can have. You can have a powerful machine, you can have medical diagnostic, but you can also do research, and it's tiny. It doesn't take up a lot of room in this Winnebago that you're flying, you know, millions of miles on. And you can do that work. So anything like that miniaturized is critical. But like the one kind of game changer thing from a research standpoint would be what we're calling lab on a chip. So we do a lot of blood sampling. We take blood samples. We take saliva samples. We take urine samples. We take poop samples, right? But then we have to bring those back to Earth.
Is that the technical
to
term?
Analyze. Yeah, poop. We call it poop. Yeah. It stands for something, but I forget what the POOP stands for.
No Star Trek name for it?
No, you know, that would be cool, but no. We do. Well, actually, we do call it fecal sampling.
Yeah.
But, you know, I figured for your podcast, you didn't want poop.
He thinks we're – no, I knew it was fecal. I thought it was funny you chose poop out of all the layman's terms you could have used for any other part of that sentence.
I didn't want to go, you know, rated R kind of
or anything.
And so we do all of that, and it takes up space. We have to have a freezer on station to freeze it. It has to be very cold, minus 80.
Wow.
And so that's a capability that takes a lot of power, takes up a lot of space. And then we have to fly them back, and right now we do that on SpaceX. Imagine if we had a small device on the station where we could do the analysis right there.
Yeah.
And not just looking at, you know, what are the minerals in your blood? What are some of the real basic things? But looking at hormones, looking at cytokines, the kind of things that will tell us your real health. And then from a research standpoint, what things are changing just on the micro level. So a lot of the times when we're doing research, the things we look at aren't clinically relevant yet. We're looking at pre-disease or pre-sickness. We see indicators way before you're actually sick. And so we need a lot more precision. We need to do things a little differently than you would just if it's purely medical. So getting a small device where we could do all those measurements, that would be a game changer for us. Another one, you heard of artificial gravity? You seen 2001 Space Odyssey, right? You know, the spinning vehicle.
Yeah.
If we can figure out a way to really spin a vehicle, that would help with lots of the problems we see with
that works via centrifugal force, right? Mm-hmm. That's okay. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because a lot of those health issues are because of the absence of
the
gravity,
microgravity.
Right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. So we say microgravity because there's no such thing as zero G, right? Okay. There's always gravity, and actually, when they're in orbit, they're exposed to the vast majority of the gravity that we have here. They're not far enough away.
Yeah.
But they're in free fall. They're traveling at 17,500 miles an hour, so they're falling. But they're going so fast they miss Earth.
Yeah.
Right? Remember back to high school physics, you can draw that vector.
Yeah.
So they just keep missing Earth. So they're in orbit and they feel weightless, but they're really exposed to gravity. It's a perception of a lack of gravity. So we call it microgravity just to separate it from.
It's interesting. That's fascinating. Man, I'm telling you, hands down, I really enjoyed every podcast. This is my new favorite. So you've got to come back on the show. We've got to take a quick break real quick, and then we're going to get back into stuff that's well beyond my intelligence. What do we have next?
Texas Rye 100. So this is actually the first all-new product from Balcones in at least 3 or 4 years. We've put out a few different iterations of our other spirits, like the Staff Selection we'll taste in a little bit, for instance. But these other products I'm talking about have all been based off of the Blue Corn or the Single Malt or Rumble. In this case, this is all brand new mash bill. We did 100% rye.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit about that?
100%
rye, so that's unusual. Why
yeah, so it's not something you find very common. And typically when you have like a Kentucky rye, of course, you know, the definition for a rye whiskey is 51% or more rye in the mash, made in the United States, aged in new charred oak barrels. The vast majority of Kentucky ryes out there, they're not nearly 100% rye. They use like kind of what they call a barely legal mash bill. So they fill it out with a lot of corn to get that kind of sweetness that you expect from, you know, a Kentucky whiskey. So 100% ryes are not super common here in the United States. A lot of craft guys are doing them, of course, but not really a lot of the big dudes. We went for 100% rye mash bill for one, because all of our other mash bills are single grain, basically. We like to really take a single ingredient and get the most out of it as possible in the final product. But one thing that's kind of unique about the rye, to us at least, is that we used 4 different kinds of rye in the mash. So when it comes to like single malt, it's all Golden Promise barley. When it comes to True Blue, it's all Blue Corn. But 4 varieties went into this one. The base rye is called Elbin, which is actually grown in North Texas. It's totally raw in the mash, so that's about 80% of it. The other 20% is a combination of chocolate, caramel, and roasted rye. So that mixture of that 20% there gives you those kind of really deep, roasty flavors.
They definitely come through.
Yeah,
all that cold brew coffee,
bittersweet chocolate, like all those notes are coming from those specialty varieties. So they really kind of lend an extra level of depth that you don't get in a lot of rye whiskeys.
Going back to prices, again, you're looking in the, I've seen it as low as 32. I mean,
yeah, the MSRP is $39.99, and you can definitely find it cheaper in some stores. But, you know, being a rye whiskey, we know it's going to be very cocktail oriented for sales. So we wanted to make sure that price is going to be competitive as well. We also have a cask strength edition, which is only a distillery release right now. We sold out of it last month at our big Rye Fest event. And kind of like the True Blue cask strength, it'll be like an annual offering, so you'll see it again next year sometime.
It's like you said, it's heavy on the chocolate notes. Mm-hmm. It's the thing about ryes, they're a controversial bag because typically with bourbons, everyone has a general idea of what they expect from that Kentucky profile, that classic Kentucky profile. And even Indiana, they're a big chunk of their bourbons tastes like what you expect bourbon to taste like, right? Smooth Ambler tastes like bourbon. With rye, the spectrum is so vast from your dark rye that Beam does, that mm-hmm. the Alberta dark rye,
yep.
to your Whistle Pig, to your Black Prince, to your Kentucky Owl. The spectrum of what you expect from a rye profile is vast. It's almost like scotch, right? You can have your honeyed, you can have your peated, you can have your sherried. Rye is the same. There's this broad spectrum. So it's one of those things that most people who enjoy rye have in their mind what they expect from rye. And if I don't know many people, like for instance, a lot of people love Russell's Reserve Rye. Or Whistle Pig. There's a big Whistle Pig following. I don't think a lot of people are broad in their scope of rye. And this is definitely something unique and interesting. And like you said, that chocolate note is just in chocolate and grain, just heavy on it.
I can't wait to make a Manhattan with this.
Oh, yeah. It works really, really well.
Now, you actually have a background in spirits as well. I mean, that's the whole reason we met was You know, for those who don't know, Steve is part of the Houston Bourbon Society. He's been part of a four-person group picking barrels for a local store for a few years now. Called I still advocate that I name them the Four Horsemen. I don't know that everyone agrees with that, but you guys have been doing these barrel picks a while, mm-hmm. and you actually work at you teach at mm-hmm. Where do you teach?
Yes, I teach at the Texas Wine School, which is on Portsmouth. Very close to the Hobbit, if you know where that restaurant is.
The Hobbit Cafe?
Yeah, it's on the backside of that.
It's a nice little cafe.
Yeah, we've moved.
The portions
are
ridiculous.
Oh, and the burgers are huge, awesome. Man. Yeah. And so we've actually moved around a couple times. This is our third location. But here we have two teaching classrooms, and we have a vault where you can rent space to store your wine, and then a members lounge with leather chairs and big screen TVs and an outdoor patio and that kind of stuff. But we teach all different kinds of classes. We teach we have two arms. We have the academic arm, which is the certifications, which I mostly do. And then we also have the consumer. We do WSET, and then we also do certification. So we have like the California Appellation Specialist certification. We have French Wine Scholar certification. There's a Sherry certification. There's they're all different kinds. And so if you like to really study and take an exam and then get letters after your name, you know, that's a great track. If you just want to come in and do tastings and like try
and learn something,
Bordeaux versus California or Oregon versus Burgundy, those kind of things, then we have a consumer track where it's mostly fun. We still lecture, so we'll stand up there and go through slides and teach you about it. But those are more based on tasting, so we do lots of tastings.
And you have a class coming up, you said?
Yes, I have a Whiskies of the World class on May 4th, which has many openings left. So if anyone's interested.
Is that tied at all to Whiskies of the World, the festival?
No, that's just the name of the class because we do Scotch, bourbon, Japanese whiskey. Not yet, but maybe we'll add one.
I think we can make that happen.
And then we'll also do – so we do an unnamed Canadian whiskey as the negative control – so scientist, right, negative control. So we taste that whiskey, and everyone says – and you know how I feel about this word.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so smooth.
Yeah.
And so everybody likes this particular – it's a very well-known brand. And then we taste –
does it involve a tiara?
Yeah, it might. Yeah.
You know, or
yeah.
Rhyme
it's very
with,
elegante, yeah.
You know, like crowns.
Yeah, drown, yeah.
Drown yeah. Royal. Or...
Yeah, so that's our control.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we start with the Japanese whiskey because it's very subtle. And I love the subtle, elegant profiles that you can get with those. And then I make them taste the Canadian whiskey again. And then we taste the Irish whiskey. So we'll do a pure pot still, like a Redbreast cask strength, which is one of my favorites. And then we taste the Canadian whiskey again. And then we'll do the scotches, and then we taste the Canadian whiskey again. And then we take – by the time we get to the bourbons, they do not want to taste that Canadian whiskey. Right? So they get to see the full profile of all the different whiskeys. Now, we don't do Indian whiskeys, or we don't do some of the more obscure things. Just we can't fit them in an intro – and it's really designed for the novice, right? A lot of the folks in our group would – find the class
kind of, yeah.
You know, and if they're just pure bourbon people, they might like it because you get to expand a little bit.
I've been advocating for that for quite some time, the expansion outside your comfort zone, mm-hmm. because there are some people who haven't enjoyed some things, but those people who have not enjoyed it have historically been very one lane mm-hmm. bourbon drinkers.
And they think everything should taste like bourbon. Right. So when you have
they're not comfortable
an Irish
with the
whiskey,
idea. Yeah.
They don't like it. Or I've heard lots of comments from bourbon people about Japanese whiskey. You know, oh, it's flavorless. Oh, it's terrible. Well, you're not trying hard enough.
Because
it's elegant. It's complex. But you have to think about it. It's more like on the wine world, it's more like a Pinot Noir. Right. It's more subtle. It's more elegant. You have to look for those flavors and really enjoy them. Whereas bourbon is like a cab from Napa where it's just going to punch you in the face.
Correct.
And give you all those flavors right up front.
There's a for those who – so I blame specifically our culture, because the way that we – most of us grow up drinking is we grow up drinking, some of us in high school, with beer and Jack and Coke, college Jack and Coke. And shots, right? Shots are a big part of our mm-hmm. culture. And I think that what we do is we end up developing these biases against the culture of drinking whiskey. The difference between us and, say, many Europeans who grow up tasting differently. They approach alcohol in a different way. So when people say smooth, I think what that really means is when they shoot it or when they drink it, depending on how fast they swallow, it doesn't cripple you as much as right. So to me, it's the burn or the effect that it has from drinking it too fast. If you approach anything slow and sipping and really try to, you know, pull it apart and kind of give it, I like that little wine thing.
Slurping.
Where you're aerating it right there in your mouth.
I teach that class.
By the way. Am I certified?
I do it all the time. I do it with water. I mean, so this is how you know how pathetic you are as a wine or spirits person. You're sitting in a restaurant with your water goblet and you're swirling it and you're smelling it and then you're slurping it. It's like, oh, come on.
Do you know who Martin Risa is? Mm-hmm. So there's this he's the U.S.'s only certified water sommelier. And it's
did he make it up?
No. There's a company. He's Austrian or German or something. And there's a company in Germany that water is treated much more differently. My English is screwed up today. In Europe than it is here. Here we do a lot of we bottle a lot of distilled water, which is horrible for you. You should be drinking spring water, stuff rich in minerals and stuff that doesn't pull from your body. And he runs this restaurant called Patina in California. But I've been following him for a while.
I know this place.
He is. Me and him both have a mutual podcast that we listen to that we're fans of, and he is in our Facebook group that I help run and. He does a sommelier course on water on different mineral contents. And in Spain, the number one bottled water is a water called Vichy Catalan, which is – so mineral content in water is measured in it's not just parts per million. It's total dissolved salts, TDS.
Yeah.
So typically something like Fiji water, I think somewhere around 36 parts per million total dissolved solids. The number one selling bottled water in Spain is Vichy Catalan, and it's like 3,000 parts per million, and it basically tastes like salt water. I mean, it'll even have like a film that develops on top, but because it's so hot there and people, it's something about rehydrating lost minerals or something. But it's treated more like medical healthy water, the way that we treat saline,
like a tonic.
Yeah. And I don't know how I got off on this stupid tangent, but the point is that I'm with you. Like, I enjoy that pulling apart, and it happens with any spirit, wine, beer. You can like do that sucking sound and kind of aerate and kind of pull apart something you're not used to. And
rum, everything is, you know, a lot of bourbon people are moving into rum now. Myself included as well. Mostly because of this tater culture, and you know that word is loaded, but we all know what we think it means.
Yeah.
The culture around bourbon has changed so much in the last 10 years. Some folks are venturing out to see what else is out there. And when the bourbon folks move into rum and then they start posting all these comments about how this rum doesn't have this and this and this, like, it's not bourbon.
Yes, exactly.
It's high ester. The flavors are supposed to be different. It's not supposed to be so woody that, you know, your gums ache. And so, you know, just opening the mind.
The Jamaican funk from like Hampton.
That stuff is amazing. Pasha made, actually, Noelle at Pasha's Bar at Rosewater. She made me a drink the other day. I said, I want something boozy and rummy. And she made me this drink that she came up with, and I forget the name.
Coconut rum and coke.
No. It was three different rums. One of them was Rimfire. So it was funky. It was clear. It was essentially like a clear old fashioned, but three different rums. Super funky. It was delicious.
Is that the rum that's been filtered to remove the color? You said it was clear.
It is colorless. So all of them are colorless. It's
there are several rums that are aged and then
quite a few.
In fact, the Real McCoy, if you actually look at their
the three year,
it's aged in a barrel, and it's got more of a off, like an old water look. Like, it's not exactly perfectly crystal clear. It's got more of a yellow tinge to it, but that's because all the color's been removed.
Yep.
We've got to go. We'll take a quick break, and we'll come right back. And I want to talk more space.
Cool.
Yeah, me too.
So you joked about the word expression. What do you teach? Do you teach marks? Do you teach expressions? When you teach a class, do you say two different bottles?
No, I use expression.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. See, I have too. I always thought the industry standard is the word expression, but there's a lot of – and again, there's this level of, when I say the word ignorance, I don't mean in an insulting sense. I mean, by definition, you don't know something. You act or behave in a way. For instance, when you talk science, I'm not stupid. I'm just ignorant to it. So,
uninformed.
Uninformed would be less insulting sounding. It's just
your stupidity is a different subject.
Correct. So we're so
for another podcast.
Yes, exactly.
We're so inclined to react to certain words in a negative sense, mm-hmm. like the word ignorance. But there's so many folks who will scoff at something that's actually quite common, mm-hmm. and it's because they're not used to seeing it. And we've got a few people in the group that kind of laugh at me saying the word expression, and I think, no, this is industry standard. Like,
yeah.
if you go to Scotland or anywhere else in the world when they're teaching, what else would you say? They don't say different marks. That's something that more like distributors would say, but brands tend to say this is our peated expression, or this is our shared expression. It's
a different expression of that distillery.
Correct. Mm-hmm. It's industry standard. So I feel vilified. So wait, not vilified. What's vilified?
Vindicated.
Mean? Vindicated.
There you go.
Vilified's not
stupidity
positive.
Is a, yeah. Vilified is like,
well,
you guys turned
another again. Again, that's another podcast. So,
well, a few drinks in, and I am stupid. So.
Do you want me to tell you about this whiskey?
Yes, yeah. Tell me about that. So this is the, for those who didn't hear us talking before the camera.
Yeah, so Balcones Staff Selection Single Barrel. And this is basically the distiller's way of giving back to the team that produces
that
the whiskey.
Different.
Basically, we let everyone vote on a kind of small curated selection of single barrels. You know, we choose one of our spirits every year. It's been single malt for the last 4 years, basically. But we choose five or six barrels that are very highly curated. They're all great, but then we let the staff kind of vote on them, and whichever one gets the highest mark is the one we bottle as the staff selection single barrel. Everyone at the distillery gets a couple bottles, and if there's any left over, we sell it at the gift shop. So it's really more intended for the employees, but it's available if you get there on the right day. So
there's a lot of heat and oak on the back end, but I love the initial hit. I think it's remarkably different than your standard single malt.
Mm-hmm.
Completely different beast. This is actually when I was there. So it was last year.
That's right. One key difference about this versus our standard single malt, aside from being a single barrel, obviously, the majority of our Texas single malt ages in new charred American oak. The staff selections for 2014 to 2017, basically, they were all Hungarian oak barrels.
Oh.
So that's part of why it has a real different kind of edge to it, because that Hungarian oak gives you a lot of the kind of, you know, sweet, sugary flavors that you get from American oak, but it's also got that kind of earthiness and that subtle dried fruit that you get from like a French oak as well.
I was just going to say, I love it when our expressions have a fruit component. So
yes.
A lot of bourbons don't. One of the reasons I really like Four Roses is they almost always have a fruit note, cherry or
that's
orange
hands
peel.
Down my favorite
and
bourbon.
Here I'm getting like mulberry, those types of fruits, and I absolutely love it when a whiskey comes forward with some fruit flavors.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It just adds to that complexity.
There's many of an argument between the Scotch and bourbon community between the variety of flavor. I argue that overall, American whiskey, bourbon whiskey is a much narrower flavor wheel compared to Scotch.
Yep, I agree.
I think you can hit a far wider range of flavors, specifically to do with barrel influence, seeing how every Scotch is made with the same three, you know, water, yeast, and barley, and then the other mixed grains. But you go sherry, peated, honeyed. I mean, I think you can hit a full spectrum, and there's even some single malts that really kind of almost taste like bourbon. Whereas bourbon is still like, it's mostly brown sugar. It's a much more narrowed, those Christmas flavors.
You got spice, you got vanilla, you got caramel, you got
chocolate,
sugar, tannin, chocolate. But yeah, it's kind of a pretty narrow profile compared to Scotch.
And I think that's where that pushback comes from a lot of people who found their niche and don't like expanding outwards, even going as so far to say that they that something is awful when really it's not your bag. Mm-hmm. You know, there's plenty of things. Perfect example, Laphroaig. Mm-hmm. People will love to say, "This is awful. It's the worst thing I've ever tasted." When there's a whole audience that thinks it's some of the most, including myself, who just loves fruity whiskey.
They did that whole campaign on honest opinions, and they literally
The right way to address feedback.
I think it
by
was amazing.
It was
so
bloody
hilarious.
Brilliant.
Yeah,
my thing was my favorite thing. So basically, Laphroaig did this campaign where they took advice. They asked people for their honest opinions, and then they projected it on a wall. And you already know this. I'm just kind of for the audience at home. But there was
I'm on the
this,
edge of my seat.
Yeah. You know what I'm going to tell you?
Yeah.
My particular feedback.
Well, go ahead.
So essentially what they did was they didn't do a great – some things kind of slipped through the cracks as to what they projected on the side of this 200-year-old distillery. And Laphroaig has this history of tasting like – burnt rubber and seaside and
Band-Aid adhesive
and iodine, and it's got a lot of – so there's a lot of jokes like it tastes like an old rubber boot that's been sitting in the bay or burnt firewood or whatever, and I had put up there that it tasted like Poseidon's taint, and they had projected it on the side of the distillery, and then it made it into an article at the UK – what's that global –
Spears business?
No, it wasn't. It was a UK online newspaper that did an article on it, and they put my Tastes Like Poseidon's Taint photo from the side of the distillery as the cover of the photo. No backlash happened.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, it was one of the funnest things about it, and I'm a huge supporter of Laphroaig, so it was one of my favorite moments of 2015 and 16. But yeah, so this is just, I'm a big fan.
All right, let's talk space.
Let's talk space. So when do lightsabers come out? Don't lie to me. What, you said
actually,
you have
better yet,
robot heads.
Better yet.
When's lightsabers
What come? Technology at NASA is codenamed lightsaber?
You know, I don't know of any. That would be my favorite, though, whatever it is.
It's got to be some kind of laser, I bet.
Yeah, see, I'm human research, so
yeah,
anything like that would be well outside of my field.
Speaking of human research, and we're going to go slightly over here, but what's this story about astronaut Scott Kelly DNA changing in space?
Is he an alien now?
You know,
that's proof that aliens exist. That he was.
You know, one on Earth now.
I hate the term fake news, but that was pretty fakey kind of news. So
you remember that episode of Spider-Man when he went to space? An astronaut went to space, picked up Venom, brought it back to Earth. That's about 7% of his. Are we going to see superheroes?
No. So what actually happened is when they did all these measures, so the first real genetic analysis that NASA has done was part of this one-year mission, and we called it the Twins Project. And it just so happened that Scott Kelly has a twin who was also an astronaut who is now retired. And so the idea being, if we study the two of them at the same time doing the same kind of measurements, well, one's on the Earth and one is in space, they've had the same kind of training, they've had the same kind of background, the big difference
similar
will
genetics.
Be this extra, theoretically identical, although we know that identical twins really still aren't identical, right? There's always some changes
difference
over time. So some of the expression...
Wait, hold on 1 second. Let me just interject.
Sure.
For those who haven't read the story... there was a story that came out after the year in space. He came back. They did a test and found out that 7% of his genetics are expressed differently.
Okay, yes.
And then everyone came
and
to
actually,
see that
it's
meeting.
Not even quite that. So
it got spread around that his genetics had changed in space.
Yeah, some reporters picked up on things and said that 7% of his DNA had changed, and that is not true. What is true is some of his gene expression had changed, and of those genes that changed expression, 7% of those had not returned to normal when they did the post-flight test.
So what does that mean that your genetics are expressed differently?
So it's just – so the purpose of your DNA is that's the blueprint, right? And then what's in the blueprint gets expressed into proteins, and the proteins are the things that actually do the work. And there are lots of things that change that expression. Working out changes your expression. Drinking some whiskey changes your expression changes all the time. Genes get turned on and off. Some get, you know, sped up, slowed down. So it's no surprise at all that the expression of some genes would change due to the stress of spaceflight. But it got misinterpreted as his DNA has mutated, and that did not happen.
Just basically, so what you're saying, I drink whiskey, the expression changes, and eventually it goes back to normal.
Yes, and even that expression isn't unusual. It changes all the time, depending on what your what proteins your body needs to do whatever it needs to do at that time. So it's not unusual at all. And some of the researchers compared it to working out or scuba diving or climbing a mountain or doing various different things. You expect the expression of some genes to change. Now, and we don't know what it means because they're still analyzing the data. The papers haven't come out or anything. So it got blown way out of proportion. It was misinterpreted. Some from media outlets just – they didn't call a biologist and say, what does this mean? They just ran with it.
They reacted from a point of ignorance.
Mm. Yeah, that's actually not so
they just they just didn't know any better. And they to them, it sounded like the sensational story of like, oh, my God, this is what happens when we're in space. And
we're all going to fry.
So is everything back to normal now, or is he still?
He hasn't done – they haven't analyzed the next time point yet. So we're still waiting to see
what
those
points?
Data look like. There are several different ones, and the problem is it takes a long time to do the analysis. So we're just waiting for those data to come in. The investigators are working on the initial paper now. In fact, it's in editorial, so we're doing all the editing on it. So it should be submitted to a journal, you know, sometime – coming up soon, and we'll get to see exactly, you know, what are the kind of things that did change, and then which things came back to normal and which things are still, we're trying to figure out what they are. But again, the DNA itself did not change.
How do you feel about what I think is probably one of the biggest threats to at least American society is this kind of we have an issue of scientific literacy. People have basically shunned science. They don't want to believe
education?
In it. There's education aspect to it.
We don't have to get into flat earth. That's what you're referring to.
But, you know, also, you know, there's everything from junk science to just like straight up conspiracy theory. Mm-hmm. How does that stuff make you feel? And what do you think the solutions are?
Oh, it's infuriating.
Yeah.
And again, since we're Facebook friends, he's probably seen this before. I rail against that on almost a weekly basis. And
what's the opposite of advocate? You're a big, not proponent. You're a big opponent.
Detractor?
To devil's advocate arguments.
Oh, I hate it. Yes.
So I almost push back on that because I tend to use that phrase a lot. In my mind, and I'm just going to explain it from my point of view, and you kind of argue against it. In my mind, I've always had I believe something based off whatever. I came to it through education, or I came across something myself that convinced me, or whatever. I've entered many discussions with people where I received new information. Mm-hmm. And before immediately going the opposite way, and we talked about this in regards to Lakewood Church. Right. So initially everyone had railed against the preacher for not, you know, Lakewood during the hurricane. Mm-hmm. They didn't open the doors fast enough. And the initial masses were like, let's burn them alive. And then little bits of information came out and it made people go the exact opposite in defense of him. And I've always believed one thing, taken in some information, and it might augment my decision. But before I completely change over, I'll pick it apart. Mm-hmm. I'll play devil's advocate to understand.
Ah, but see, there's a difference. That is not the definition of devil's advocate.
Okay, what's devil's advocate?
The devil's advocate is when you are arguing a position that you do not believe in solely for the sake of making argument. So it was developed by the church as a way of arguing against someone becoming a saint, right? So they had to appoint someone to say, we need someone to argue against it. So, you know, even if you believe it, you have to argue against it. No matter what the data say, you have to argue against it. So that person argues against it regardless of what's going on. So the definition of a devil's advocate is making an argument that you don't believe in solely for the sake of making an argument. And it happens in science all the time. And you'll get up and give your presentation and someone will say, I'm playing devil's advocate. And what they're really doing is pushing their own agenda and pushing their own ideas.
And pushing your buttons.
Exactly. But they get this protection from being devil's advocates. Like, oh, well, they're just playing devil's advocate. They don't really believe that. No, most of the time they do.
Yeah.
So it's not really devil's advocate. They believe their position. They're just asking a question, but they're trying to gain some kind of
ground
legitimacy and protection by invoking the sacred a devil's advocate. So that's my problem.
Well, let me argue with that, because one thing that's a lot of people forget about the English language, and yeah, all right. So do you have 5 minutes? Okay. So the English language, and a lot of people forget about this, changes based solely off the misuse of it. Meaning words are created or definitions are changed simply because enough people were using it wrong long enough.
Like the word literally.
Like the word irregardless.
Oh.
So the word irregardless.
Not a word, but it is now.
But it is now. It wasn't a word. It became a word. It's got a definition. It's in the. So by all means, the authorities that be have deemed it a word. However, it is a. Not improper. There's a word for it. Not formal or
informal.
Informal. So casual. It's a word. You still shouldn't use it. But when people say it's not a word, they're technically wrong.
Right.
So devil's advocate may have originally meant one thing, but it has become the argument of I like the idea of us discussing something, debating something, and pulling everything I believe apart, finding the cracks and holes. Because all that's going to do is cement my belief in something, reinforce it, or more importantly, it may teach me something new. I may change my perspective and solidify that. So I have always referred to devil's advocate as a way to either learn, expand, or solidify what I already believe.
So if you're asking questions, everyone should always ask questions. In fact, when you're a graduate student, the whole idea of science is to ask questions and not believe anything that anyone tells you. Right, so you challenge everything, even your own work. In fact, you should be your own harshest critic. So we abuse each other all the time, but we don't say, well, I'm playing devil's advocate here. No, I'm saying, I don't believe you.
Right.
Prove it to me.
Yeah.
Show me this. Why did you do – instead of saying, I'm playing the devil's advocate here, and you know, what if this is true? Instead saying, did you consider all the options, and why did you choose – that hypothesis? Why did you choose that conclusion instead of evoking the sacred devil's advocate? Because a lot of it is perception, right? People think, well, if you say devil's advocate, well, then, you know, that's it's a fair argument. It's logical. It's actually not logical for science. So I just think it's misused. I think it's people misunderstand it. And I think it gets a status that it doesn't deserve, because often people aren't using it in the terms that it's meant to be used.
I kind of hijacked Winston's question, but as far as people, because essentially the question was, how do you feel about the age of people bucking truth, science, and the process of discovering truth? Because there's a formula for it. You're supposed to, you develop a hypothesis.
Yeah,
you're
supposed to test it out. Scientific method.
Yeah, scientific method exists for a reason. The thing that drives, that blows my mind is, school standards have only increased, right? So it's become harder and harder. When I was in school, my parents didn't grasp the mathematic homework I brought home. It was beyond them. And as Texas standards increase in education, I assume they continue to increase, there's stuff my daughter has brought home, who's 12, that I start to scratch my head and Google. And I would think that if the standards for education have increased, we should be a smarter population, but you are in the age of...
We're lagging behind the rest of the world.
The standards may or may not have increased. I think the problem is funding to a large degree. You know, we're constantly cutting funding from education, whether it be teacher salaries or whether or not we can put computers in the classrooms. And I think those things have probably a more drastic impact.
I think funding is an issue, and I think... But what is taught is an issue. How many education boards do we have where the people on the boards have no educational background?
Yep.
They're not teachers. They're not scientists. They have no real education about how to do that work. And yet their own personal beliefs, I'll go there, their own mostly religious beliefs dictate what should be taught in the classroom, and science suffers. We see that over and over again.
I think it's fair to say that there is an emotional influence, whether it be religion or otherwise, that has definitely driven has been such a buck against science for a long time, right? Because I remember when they started pushing the idea of certain things that should no longer be taught in school, like creation theory, you know, and there's been people who've argued that you should still be able to talk about it in school. And there's an emotional trend that has pushed against science so hard, such the opposite direction, that sure, that may be part of the reason we're in the position we're in. I think it largely has to do with the internet. And a great example of this, in my opinion, I'm saying my own thing is a great example, is whiskey and the Facebook forums. You've got people who aren't necessarily certified or don't work in the industry, but are on Facebook all day that they think they know what they're talking about. And I think we live in the age of Google. People do a little Google research, find out vaccines cause autism, and then screw what I heard in college and high school.
Yeah.
I don't need college. I've got Google. I don't think it's necessarily religion as much as it is an arrogance of the internet. And it happens all the time in the bourbon community.
Yeah, I can't tell you how many times I've been on Reddit and someone says, well, why don't you make the whiskey this way? And I'm like, well, because we like doing it this way. And they're like, but it would be much better if you did it this way. And I'm
bourbon
like, well, then.
Bourbon only needs to be made in Kentucky.
Yeah. Well,
it's not bourbon because it's charcoal
filtered.
I just
tell people if you think you can do it better, then you're more than welcome.
There's this pompacity. There's this pompousness that happens.
New word of the day.
There you go.
Ding.
There's this pompous arrogance that comes with the age of enlightenment. And it's funny, I would say that this is the age of enlightenment, but at the same time, we're too stupid as a human race to not let our emotional influence tell us we shouldn't be reading this without more verification or more education on the subject. Listen, we can continue this in a few minutes. I know we went 10 minutes over. Just keep going? You sure?
Yeah, I'm gonna find a cutting point.
At this point,
you'll find a cutting
go.
Point? So, all right, so we can keep going for the full half hour? All right, so
wicked.
20 more minutes, I'll take it.
All right.
Oh, that's awesome.
Great.
So, yeah, I don't think it's religion as much as it is. Sure, there's a part of it. Sure.
Especially when we're talking about education boards, because those are the folks who intentionally get on the board to influence what's taught.
Sure.
Yep.
Specifically science.
Yeah, and there's a political side of that too.
Yep, absolutely.
Where those running for office that affects our educational system run on platforms of religion playing on that aspect. And and this is not necessarily an anti-religious podcast.
No, we're just kind of
discussing the whole spectrum of it.
Is this the most political podcast
you've
had?
Yeah.
Wow, really? Uh-oh.
Yeah. Well, Pasha said Malibu coconut rum was garbage, so maybe that was the...
Ooh, wow.
What happens if we agree with that?
Yeah. So what is Pasha under you? Or what's the...
I'm not in that group anymore, but when I was in his group, I was the element scientist. So I was the chief scientist for that entire subgroup. And he is the lead of the contractors who actually do the real work
in
that group. So we've worked – and actually, when I was running the cardio lab, we worked with Pasha. So I've been working with Pasha for 15 years.
Yeah, I know. And for those who've heard us, anytime we say the word Pasha on this podcast, it only refers to one person. Pasha –
it's like Cher.
Yeah.
Right?
Pasha running Rosewater, who's got a passion in spirits, also works. And he was actually part of the team that actually determined that Scott Kelly's –
he was the primary point of contact with the Kelly brothers.
So was it his fault it was leaked to the media?
No, not at all. Pasha does a great job.
I can just hear him at a bar right now.
Gotta
so check
these
this out.
Leakers to the fake news media.
No, Pasha does a great job. We all love Pasha.
This was tremendously generous of you to bring this on the show.
How do you like it?
It's the nose is incredible. It tastes so different than I was expecting.
Mm.
I tasted this 3 years ago, but I had already had a bunch of other pours of something, and believe it or not, this is not a bunch of other pours. It's got this sugary fruit aftertaste. I can't quite put my finger on it.
Kind of apple-y. I get like red apple skin, a little bit of that kind of apple-ish acid.
This is the Colonel E.H. Taylor Warehouse C Tornado Surviving Bottled in Bond Bourbon.
Don't ask what the secondary price is.
I was just going to say, I hope you don't know what the secondary price is.
I know now. I was going to buy it from him, and then I looked up. I was like, oof.
I would rather share it than sell it.
Oh, that's very kind of you. And just the fact that you brought it today is really interesting. I like the idea, and I've said this before. I've had on industry folks on the show, and I love the idea of drinking with industry folks. But I love the idea more of interesting folks within the bourbon community, because one thing I've found is I don't know what it is, but the bourbon community, the whiskey drinking community in general, it might have to do with the fact that you have to be a little bit more liquid to be able to be in this hobby. But there is a vast number of vastly fascinating, like just hugely interesting folks within the community that are worth talking to. Pasha's one, you're one. There's several people I know that have just been involved from one thing to the next that are worth talking to that I'd like to get on the show and just kind of talk. I'd love to talk Star Wars and whiskey all at the same time, and, you know, and just kind of, you know, pick apart what we're drinking and at the same time find out, you know, did he grow a tail in space or, you know, just the whole thing is just so much fun for me.
What is the facility you work at like? I'm just curious because I don't know.
Are you in that black building right off the Bay Area and Space Center?
No, I'm.
It's a building
inside. Inside, yeah, I'm inside the fence at JSC. I'm in building one.
Okay, so you're actually in the.
Yep, I'm in the facility, and it's just offices.
Yeah.
But when I was in the laboratory, we had half a building. And we had several large rooms that we had set up to do testing. So we had our ultrasound machines and our EKG, because we were cardiovascular, so our EKG machines, blood pressure monitors, tables that we could tilt people on, because one of the big problems that astronauts used to have coming back from space was blood pressure control. Because of some of the physiological changes that go on, once they come back from space, it stays the same up there, but when they come back to Earth, and gravity pulls that fluid down to their legs, they can't maintain their blood pressure. And it's not every astronaut.
So it weakens their heart while they're in space.
Well, the mass of their heart gets a little smaller. It's mostly, shift. It's a fluid shift kind of thing. That's a little controversial. Some groups have said that it's just the fluid, and then other groups have said that there's a little bit of atrophy as well. But it's, like,
so 7%. Smart. Did you understand that? You want me to explain it?
I know what atrophy is.
I'm just trying to sound smart for a minute. Yeah. So essentially with...
Why don't you make up another word, Chris?
Pompacity. No, so the thought being that when you're in space, your heart's not having to work as hard.
As hard, yeah.
So when you come back, it's having to strain itself a bit.
So think about when we're standing here on Earth, we are, I'm going to throw hydrostatic. We're a hydrostatic column of water. Right. So the pressure, we're mostly water. So the pressure of gravity pushes fluid down. So we have anywhere from a liter to a liter and a half of fluid just kind of hanging out outside of the central circulation. And some of that's in the gut, some of that's in the legs. When you go into space, all that fluid moves up and your body senses that. So if you look at a picture of an astronaut, their faces are puffy. Sometimes they're almost unrecognizable. We call it the puffy face chicken leg syndrome because their legs get smaller.
Yeah.
And that's a fluid shift. But then your body gets used to that and you lose fluid to try and account for that change in volume to get you back. And we call that we have different words for it based on whether it's adaptive for space or if it's not, or if it's, a normal Earth. So we call it euvolemia in space because it's the space normal. Right, it's not on the Earth. We call it hypovolemia. They don't have enough fluid, but for space, that's the normal amount. But as soon as they come back, and gravity pulls that fluid back down, now you don't have enough fluid.
They look real thin in the face, gaunt,
and they get pale, and they can't. Their heart rate can't make up for that change in volume, so they get low blood pressure and they can faint. And it's only like 25% of the crew for short duration missions, about 80% of the crew for long duration missions. But we've developed countermeasures for that. So the exercises we do now helps prevent it. We do fluid loading in space, so they take salt tablets and water. And then we also have a compression garment. So we have controlled that. Even though we know it's a problem and it's physiological, we can control it when they come back to Earth. The big question is, can we control it with Mars? And so that's something that we're still thinking of. But anyway, that's a long story, long kind of outjut of, we had a whole bunch of equipment that goes bing in the laboratory, right?
Yeah.
And we had a couple laboratories and compressed gases and things because we would have to change gases and have oxygen stuff. So it was a typical laboratory when we were doing that.
So if I went into space for a year, two questions. One, how long until I recover? And two, how soon can I drink whiskey?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Okay, let me piggyback on that. You guys, no alcohol in space?
As far as I know, that's correct.
Is it just to prevent any issues, or is there a specific medical reason?
Their fluid's already kind of different, and we know that alcohol can dehydrate you, so that could be a potential issue. And another would be the behavioral aspects of drinking alcohol. But as far as I know, no alcohol.
I read,
there are all kinds of rumors.
I can't verify the veracity of this, obviously, but I read that fake long news. Ago, part of the astronaut meal regimen was sherry in dessert. That was the only alcohol that I ever found
about. They actually tried to do that. I read an article about that as well. But they never really did it because by the time they changed the packaging and did what they needed to do, it tasted disgusting. So nobody wanted it. But early on, I remember reading about that endeavor to try and do that.
Yeah. One of my big dreams is to put a bottle of whiskey in space. And being that, you know, there's a SpaceX testing facility right outside of Waco, I thought, like, all right, there's got to be an angle for this. But I tried to do some research and figure out, like, has whiskey ever been in space? Like, that's a really good question.
Mm-hmm. Ardbeg. Yes. No. I was about to say Ardbeg.
No, they didn't send actual whiskey, as far as I know. They sent components of whiskey.
I thought they sent a vial of their actual whiskey up there, which isn't enough, I think, of a sample size to... Because they aged... Basically, they did the twin study, the way I understand it, and you could be right. The way I understand it is they took a vial of a cask, aged it down here, put the sample up there, and tried to see the difference when it came back.
You see, what I understood was they sent a component of whiskey called like terpenes or something like that. Not something I'm familiar with, but everything I read, nothing said anything about an actual bottle of Ardbeg going into space. Not even actual whiskey, components of whiskey only.
Because they did a tour of the vial throughout the country, and at Specs downtown they had an actual plastic rocket ship, and in the center was a vial of that had supposedly been to space. And then of course I think they added a few drops of that into the next batch, which ended up being their perpetuum, I think. No, not perpetuum. What's the Ardbeg release they did with the rocket on the front?
Galileo?
Yeah, that was it. Yeah. So, I mean, I could be wrong. Definitely worth looking into later. Either way, I would like to see it eventually make it up there, but I would imagine
I think Elon Musk's little Tesla floating around the Earth, like, just needs a bottle of whiskey.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
I mean, watching that whole thing on TV.
Did you see the memes around that?
Oh, yeah. Oh.
Where there was a dead still body coming in there. Out.
Yeah.
And then like watching those... You can't get caught for murder if the body gets into space.
Watching those two rocket boosters land simultaneously. I mean, that was just...
That's got to be
exciting. For us, that was thrilling. It was amazing. People stood up and clapped when those things landed. Yeah. It was just amazing.
Even Elon was like, holy F, it's in space. You know, like, it worked.
What do you think... How does weight work in space? Was there a big weight difference? This is an expansive, rambling question, so let me get it all out. But with the twin study, were they on similar calories daily? And if so... Were they similar weights when they left? And how does weight work in space? Did he lose weight? Did he gain weight? What was the – can you talk about that?
Yeah, I don't know his specific results.
I'm wondering if it's easier or harder to lose weight in space.
Generally, it's easier because your taste buds lose a lot of their ability to function.
Same thing happens on planes. Everything tastes bland. Yeah,
really?
So we fly a lot of like hot sauce and other things to increase the flavor of the food. And for a long time, our foods had a relatively high salt content because we need to make it palatable. Because if you can't taste it, I mean, if your cat's sick or your dog's sick, then they don't eat. And humans are kind of the same way. We're animals. If your food doesn't taste like anything, you don't eat. It's hard to get in the number of calories you need. So people just don't feel like eating because it doesn't taste like anything. So that's something that's worked on. But people typically tend to lose weight, although with our new exercise devices out there, that helps prevent some of that.
Is the Colbert still up there?
Yeah.
The treadmill?
Yep, the T2. Yeah, it's up there.
I've historically been a Stephen Colbert fan, and I remember the episode where they had – named a treadmill effectively after him, and they named it the Colbert.
Yeah. That's great.
So when you say you typically lose weight, is it a significant amount? Are we talking a few pounds just from?
Yeah, if you, I mean, nothing like your skin and bones or anything, but you lose enough weight where, you know, your clothes might not fit when you come back or something like that. But in order to do their work, especially if we're going to go to Mars, stay there for a while, do work, and then come back, we need to make sure they can still do that work. And you don't want them losing weight and losing muscle tone and losing strength and those kind of things.
Especially for, what you said, 30 months or 30 weeks?
Potentially about 30 months.
Just to get to
for
Mars.
For a round trip. Round
then
trip.
All of a sudden they can't even stand.
Yeah, so we don't want that. Right, so those are the kind of things we work on. So we have a device on the station that can do a lot of exercise, and it works really well.
The as seen on TV Fletcher things.
Our next question, though, is when we're going to Mars, we can't have a 600-pound, even though weight in space isn't weight.
Different, yeah.
Right, we have mass and we have weight. So we have mass in space, but we don't have weight. So things weigh a lot less, but it's big. Right. So how do we do the exercise going to Mars? And that's something we're working on right now. There are a couple prototype things that we're working on, and people are doing tests and all of that. And hopefully we can get that on the space station so we can do some tests in microgravity. But those are all questions, you know, moving forward. How do we do? We know a lot of what we can do on the space station. But the space station is in low Earth orbit. It's still protected by the Earth's magnetic field, right? So they don't get the same level of radiation exposure. It's pretty easy to get them home if we need to. And all of these things are going to change when we're trying to go to Mars. So all of these things are concerns for us. How do we build everything so they can be autonomous? Because once they're at Mars, it's 20-minute comm delay each way.
Yeah.
So if they have an emergency and say, Houston, we have a problem.
And you guys say, what?
It takes 40 minutes for it to get back to them. Good Lord. You know, we can't really do that. So our training has to be different. Our systems need to be a little bit different.
Are you guys
Those
working
are
on ways
all
to
things
improve
we're
that?
Working on now. Absolutely. How? So we, several different things. Autonomous, right? So autonomy is a big thing. And then just-in-time training. So we can't train them for everything here on Earth. But we can create computer programs, AI, virtual reality, those kind of things, so that if they have a problem, they can put on the goggles and it teaches them how to do it as they're doing it. So we call that
effectively
just-in-time training.
It's what we do on YouTube when I need to change my dishwasher. I just look up how to install a dishwasher and
essentially,
all of a sudden you learn something.
A little more technologically savvy
Kung
than
Fu.
That. Yeah.
Matrix reference.
Awesome. Yes, we're not geeks at all.
So, I'm sorry. My question was more directed towards, are you guys working on ways to shorten the amount of time in between communications?
I mean, that's limited by physics.
Right. So we can't really do that.
I think the only solution would be if there was some kind of communication device built off of, like, quantum entanglement.
Some subspace.
Still seems, sounds like sci-fi at this point.
It is.
Right.
At this point,
I didn't think it was dependent on...
it's distance.
Right. Yeah. Right. Because... I guess in my mind, I'm translating it to something I'm familiar with. And what I'm familiar with is when they developed when the internet became the internet and they used to trade stocks, they would, you know, call and there'd be like a several minute difference between calling in California to calling to New York. And now you're able to run programs that can make trades faster than it would take, you know, in an instant between California and New York due to the internet. So in my mind, I was thinking there's a way to, this is going to sound so stupid, to increase the internet speed, the dial-up speed between Earth and the space station to make comms more instant.
Some of the changes you're talking about were because we went from analog to digital. We went from copper wires to fiber optics. So now we're not talking about how long does it take for sound to get there. We're talking about how long does it take light to get there, and that's a huge difference.
Yeah. And that's what you're working on in space is the speed of light.
Yep. And now there are some technologies that people are bringing forward for potential ways to communicate using a light path instead of a sound path. Those are research, right? Those are kind of the cool future funky things. I just recently was at a conference where one of the presenters was talking about that. They were talking about how much they can increase the bandwidth by using light laser instead of trying to use the communication systems we're used to now.
An Earth version of a laser pointer pointed at the station Like we do with planes, right? That's essentially what you're saying.
I don't know if you do it with planes. I don't.
I don't do it with planes. It's a federal crime. Right?
I wouldn't admit to that on air,
right?
A fiber optics kite wire from the U.S. to the station, just some sort, something faster is what you're essentially saying. A beam.
Is there
of light.
A faster way to do it, and yeah. What would those ways be within the laws of physics?
And right now, you're working on radio, or
you know, I'm not that's
different wavelengths
outside my field. I believe that it's radio. Yeah. But it's clearly slower than what light would be. Otherwise, we wouldn't have that 20-minute comm delay each direction. Mm-hmm. And we have a very short comm delay to station, but it's very manageable.
So I got to really just thank both of you. Both. Thank you. Let's try that again. Cut.
Too much whiskey.
My tongue's numb. So, the 100-proof, high-proof stuff, and, you know, there's
that
60.
It has that effect. I mean, it's like you can have one drink of cast-strength stuff, and your tongue just starts.
Every time I have a snow cone, my tongue just becomes a complete numb mess. So thank you both for coming. I gotta have you back on. I'd love to have you both back on
anytime. Let me know.
I think this is going to be far more entertaining. The episode with Peerless was by far our most popular. It was watched more complete than any other episode, meaning more people watched the full thing. I think this is going to be up there. Either way, thank you so much for coming on, Steve.
Welcome.
I had an absolute blast. Winston, buddy, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And
happy to be here.
Cheers, guys.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.